I looked at my clock on the computer. I mean, it's to the second that touches the 12, you know, it's right on the money. And I also have timed it with Fort Collins, Colorado. You know, listen to it over the air. You know, put on 10 megacycles. You can get Fort Collins on, you know, on 2.5, 5, 10, 15, and 20. I always use 10. And right on the money. I mean, the exact second. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, I found the site, by the way. If you type into your browser time.is, T-I-M.is, it comes up with the exact time, and it tells you the difference between your system, your computer system clock, and the accurate result. Mine is minus 0.138 seconds off of the exact time, which is pretty good.
It says here your time is exact, 10:01:54 and counting.
Okay, good. So your operating system is checking in with the NTP every so often and synchronizing, because if you were just doing this based on the crystal oscillator of your computer, it wouldn't be that close. So something in the Apple software is calling home or someplace else and checking its watch.
Yeah. I was looking at some other sites, too. It's down to the exact split second, you know, so I guess it's okay.
WB2EAB.
Yes, Ed.
If you're getting really, really detailed about time down to microseconds or even milliseconds, you have to take into account the propagation delay time for the signal over the air or through the internet or whatever to get to, from the source to you.
That's true, but you could also measure the latency figures. It doesn't really have to be that exact, but it can't be 5 or 6 seconds fast or slow with FT8 or other digital technologies that are new to us all. So I was just cautioning people that if you let a computer just clock run over time, it'll end up being fast or slow. There's not much you can do about it unless the operating system uses NTP to check its time and correct it.
Well, once upon a time, I was doing stuff that we needed time to better than a millisecond, and we were using WWB over the air, and they gave us an estimated fudge factor of 10 milliseconds to account for the time as soon as the propagated across the country.
Okay, well, that's reasonably good to be able to calculate. You know the location of the transmitter, you know the location of the receiver. You can kind of fudge reflections and distances and come up with an approximate delay due to the speed of light.
Precisely.
It says here, your time is exact. The difference from time.is was minus 0.006 seconds plus or minus 0.025 seconds. Time in New York, United States is now 10:04:43 and counting.
Okay, very good. Yours is more, mine says it's exact too, but my numbers are minus 0.138 seconds. But like I said before, as long as it's within a second, it's fine. You know, it's just that some people don't know, so they don't check on it, and then they wonder why FT8 doesn't seem to be working for them. That's all.
QSL Roy, thank you very much for your knowledge and your time.
You're welcome, David. Well, it's 10:05, so I think I have enough time for one puzzle. Now, I was thinking of this for a while because it's right after April Fool's Day, and I was corresponding with Dick used to call him Mike Number One. It's KC2NJI, who hosts the AmateurRadio.tv website. And he was telling me a story, which unfortunately I don't recall, but I believe him. He said that he could only recall that Dick got annoyed by one question. And if you remember, Dick often would say that there's no such thing as a silly question or a stupid question or a foolish question, that any question a person has deserves to be answered. So I don't know whether he was really annoyed by it or there was something else going on, but I thought I would kind of dust it off and present it to the general public here, assuming that none of you guys remembers the story and or the answer, if there was one. So, this is the question that apparently was asked of Dick K2RIW that moderately annoyed him. The question I offer you guys tonight is, does the state of a battery, in other words, a fresh battery versus a used-up battery, have any effect on whether the battery bounces higher or lower or what have you? So in other words, is there such a thing as bouncing a battery and judging how much it bounces? You can estimate the charge state of a battery. So I throw that out to the public.
Yes, AM2P. Yes, definitely.
Okay, AF2P, would you like to expand? What's going on there?
I don't know what the reason is, but I read about it on the internet a couple of years back. And you take a double A cell, you bounce it off the desk. If it's fully charged, it doesn't bounce that much. If it's out of charge, it bounces much higher, or vice versa. But I've done it on a number of occasions. It's absolutely true. For a double A.
Try now.
Yes, Ed.
These days, it is cheap enough to get the digital voltmeter and not have to play these stupid games. And I frankly do not believe that comment about the bounce for a microsecond. Let me just say, though, if you really want to run a test, Try dropping a car battery to see how far it bounces. Oh, wait a minute, it'll shatter and collapse. Never mind.
Try it. Don't you don't have to believe it. You can try it. Prove it to yourself. Double A battery.
I will do so right now.
Okay, and while Ed tries it himself, Frank was on EchoLink. Again, I don't know if it's because the audio dropped out or Frank had a comment. So let's leave the repeater quiet for a second or two and give Frank an opportunity.
Just letting you know that EchoLink timed out this time. Thanks. WB2BX.
Okay, that's an ongoing problem, unfortunately. So, anyone else with any comments on this subject? Do they believe that the bounce changes? In what direction does the bounce change? And if you really want to play serious with this, any theories of why the bounce would change? Okay, it seems that we don't have a lot of takers on this particular one. I want to give Ed an opportunity to find a AA battery and throw it on the ground and see what happens. I hope he doesn't experiment with those automotive lead acid batteries.
I have my test results.
And what have you found, Ed?
I have in my hand two double A, old-fashioned carbon zinc batteries, one of which is brand new, the other one has been lying buried in my night table for a couple of years, and I dropped them on the tile of the bathroom floor, and he's right. They both bounce a little. Either one bounces a lot, but the dead one is definitely noticeably bouncing higher than the good one. I drop them about 4 or 5 inches. The good one only bounces about a quarter of an inch, and the bad one bounces 3/4 of an inch to 1 inch. I have no idea why, but I have to say, he's right.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
Something I've noticed over the years, you take a good battery like a Duracell or EverReady, and you feel the weight of that, you know, it's the same voltage as a, one of these, you know, cheap, you know, Chinese batteries somewhere that, you know, brand new, and there's definitely a difference in the weight. You know, I've never actually weighed it, but you can feel it.
Okay, I don't think there's much really a change in mass. I'll have to kind of look that up. The primary battery that everyone uses for this little experiment, and I will put up a link where you can read all about it, and there's even a place where you can look at a video of someone doing it, is alkaline batteries. Alkaline batteries have two electrodes. One is zinc metal. The other is manganese dioxide. Zinc metal, and usually there's a little water added into the mix of a fresh new battery. So the zinc metal is not really elastic, so when you drop it, it just kind of thuds. Over time and use, a battery will operate like all batteries. They're chemical reactions, they're oxidation reduction reactions in which the electron transfer is pushed outside and gives the power to whatever circuit you have. So as time goes on, the zinc is oxidized to zinc oxide. The manganese dioxide is reduced to manganese oxide, and a little bit of alkali is produced. Let me drop for a sec. So what's really going on is the zinc powder and the couple of drops of water kind of slosh around and kind of kill the elasticity of the battery. But as you discharge a battery, it peaks at around 75% spent. A lot of the zinc powder is reduced to a very, very brittle, solid a bunch of zinc oxide powder. The water is turned into something else, so it dries out, and it's kind of like almost a rock. So it's more elastic when it is spent. And you can tell that easily. It reaches its maximum, apparently, with approximately 75% of discharge of an alkaline battery. Beyond that point, you really can't tell the difference between one that's 75% spent and one that's 99% spent. So that's the answer, as Ed AF2P mentioned, that batteries, at least alkaline batteries, if you drop them, the fully charged ones kind of land with a thud, and the partially discharged ones will bounce back to you.
KD2FRU, quick question.
Yes, George.
And this is with alkaline, non-rechargeable batteries only that you're talking about here, correct?
I just did the same test with carbon zinc.
Well, yes, carbon zinc would probably work very similar because, again, it uses zinc as one of the cathodes, and as it becomes oxidized, it also is reduced to zinc oxide. It's just that most of the experiments you're going to see on YouTube and such, people are going to use newer alkaline-based batteries. And getting back to George's question, yeah, this only comes into effect with a zinc electrode-based battery. The batteries that are designed to be rechargeable, the nickel-cadmium, the nickel metal hydride, and the lithium, all use different chemistries. And so
It doesn't work with them.
Roy?
KD2FIU, yes. Roy, and the difference made there is that these batteries do produce a voltage, whereas the other batteries have to be satisfied with a voltage to actually store it. They're not producing, they are storage batteries versus producing voltage batteries.
I see it as the zinc is actually rotting away. For a rechargeable, you don't have that.
Well, with a rechargeable, you have a reversible chemical reaction. Ultimately, all batteries, not supercapacitors, because those are different things, all batteries are chemical reactants in which the anode and the cathode is undertaking a transfer of electrons, and they are able to manipulate the transfer of electrons externally so you can run circuits. But they all run on chemical reactions. Some of them can go in reverse. So if you apply a reverse potential to a rechargeable battery, you will hopefully regenerate the cathode and anode and be able to recharge its chemical reactants and allow it to work again. Different chemistries and different technologies have different number of cycle times. Eventually, all good things come to an end, and you can reverse the chemical reactions only so many times, and things start to happen with the cathode or the anode. They become coated, or they start to disintegrate, or they develop bridges. There's mechanical and electrochemical failures of all kinds. But the only real difference between a rechargeable battery and a non-rechargeable battery is a rechargeable battery is able to have its chemical reactions reversed. You see that with lead acid cells. By just reversing the voltage potential, you switch the reduction oxidation to the other side, and you basically regenerate the cathodes for the next time that you need the battery.
KD2FIU, Roy?
Yes, George.
From what I understand, a rechargeable battery does not actually produce charge. As in reverse chargeable battery that it is, it accepts charge and depletes.
Well, I wouldn't think of it that way at all. Take something like a lead acid battery. The first time you use a lead acid battery, the electrodes are fully functioning. It'll give you a potential. It'll give you a current. It'll eat away the cathode until it runs out of the ability to transfer electrons in an oxidation reduction chemical reaction. But if you then apply an external voltage potential high enough, you reverse all of those reactions chemically in each cell, and you regenerate the cathode and anode, and it's like it was relatively when it was new. So I don't know. I wouldn't kind of consider charge as more of a capacitor. In this, you are actually applying a reverse voltage potential and driving an oxidation reduction a reaction in reverse.
Roy, understand. You understand the wet cell. Understand the wet cell, but I'm talking about the dry cell here. The dry cell rechargeable, from what I understand, does not generate any voltages. It accepts voltages. It stores them.
No, George, I'm afraid not. You're describing a capacitor, and there are devices with very, very high capacitance, and especially in small electronic watches where the current required is minimal, and so it just it charges up a capacitor. But actual lithium-ion batteries, nickel-cadmium, metal hydroxides all operate the same oxidation reduction chemical reactions. They are not capacitors. They don't hold a charge between their contacts.
Very simple, right?
Yes, Ed. Assume you have it.
A capacitor stores a charge as an electrical field between two metallic plates across a dielectric. A rechargeable battery stores a charge and then regenerates it through chemical reactions. The rest is detailed.
Yes, I would agree with you, Ed. And also, one of the many differences is if you take a capacitor that's capable of, you know, I don't know, 100 volts it can tolerate, and you put a charge of 50 volts on it, after enough time, it'll charge very close to 50 volt potential. If you take a rechargeable battery that's rated for 3.6 volts, and you apply 12 volts to it, and you don't burn it out, in the end, the best that you could get is a battery that's putting out 3.6 volts because it's not holding a charge with the voltage potential that you use to charge it. It simply has this oxidation reduction reaction going, and the electronegativity of the cathode and the anode determines the voltage potential of any chemical battery.
KD2FIU?
Yes, George.
Ed described it exactly the way I originally understood it.
Okay, it's just the point that lithium ion, nickel metal hydride, and nickel cadmium don't work like the capacitors. Capacitors work like capacitors, but all of the rechargeable batteries that I mentioned work as chemical generators of voltage potential.
Now, can I be ornery?
Feel free.
I could go into Harbor Freight and buy a multi-function digital voltmeter that will tell me the open circuit voltage of a battery to a millivolt. And I can go next door into a Starbucks and get myself a cup of coffee. Guess which one costs more?
5 bucks.
My point is, well, we can get a voltmeter accurate and readable to a millivolt for less than a Starbucks cup of coffee. There is no reason not to have one to test a battery, is the question.
I think anyone in this hobby or people not in this hobby should have one. So I'm, yeah. Harbor Freight, I don't know if that's commending inexpensive Chinese equipment or yelling and screaming about how coffee has gotten overpriced.
All of the above.
I generally think that both ohmmeters are relatively inexpensive. The cheaper ones might not be quite as accurate as an engineer might need, but almost with the exception of a few people listening tonight, none of us are engineers. So at the very least, you know, I always wonder at a ham that doesn't have a volt ohmmeter, but that's my 2 cents worth. But I thought it was an interesting question. I do not know whether Dick actually considered it an annoyance. I find it somewhat hard to believe. I've asked Mike what episode, what week, what Sunday it was, and I don't think he recalls exactly, but I thought it was a nice opportunity to pull out something interesting from the past. I had another thing planned for tonight, but we've run out of time. There is some images on my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com, of two radiometers. So when you have nothing better to do, take a look at them, and hopefully next Sunday when we have a wee bit more time, we'll discuss them, and hopefully some people will learn something new, and other people will be reminded of things they might have forgotten, but I think it'll be a nice basis for some conversation, but for next Sunday, because we're really running out of time. So with that in mind, I want to thank everyone who participated tonight. Again, a very nice, lively participation and conversation. The chat room was busy. The streams were busy. So I thank everyone who participated. I hope that you'll join us again next Sunday when we try and do it all over again. But now it's 10:26. It's time for Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
AC2GS WS2N. Yeah, I looked at your website. I saw the radiometer there, and that was one of Dick's favorite topics too. You know, does that thing spin because of heat, or is it because of the actual photons that were hitting it? And that was always very controversial. But I have a related topic coming up to that right after I go over the launches and landing topic here. But anyway, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. I got one launch coming up on the 6th, a couple of days from now. And it's a crew mission that's going to go to the International Space Station. But it's by a private company. Axiom is a private company that is developing a space station. They would like to hook their first module up to the International Space Station. And as they grow, you know, two or three or four modules after that, as time goes on, and the International Space Station eventually comes to an end, they will separate their modules and their solar panel and everything, and it would separate from the space station. It would become an independent commercial space station. But they don't have that yet, but they do have a crew of four people that will be taking off in a Dragon vehicle, crew Dragon vehicle from Launch Complex 39A on the 6th. If you're home in the daytime, or you could always watch it on YouTube later on at 12:05, you'll be launching to the International Space Station. They're not staying for 6 months like a regular NASA crew, but NASA did approve these people to go up. They're paying, these four people that are going up are paying SpaceX to, for this ride up to the space station and ride back home. Eventually they'll land in the Atlantic Ocean or the Gulf of Mexico, depending on the weather. But it's a 10-day trip. They'll stay on board for 10 days. Right now there's a crew up on the space station of 7 people, so that'll add 10 for a while. They'll be up to 10. And they have planned science experiments. They plan on using themselves as guinea pigs. They're going to be poking needles in their arms, doing all kinds of things. I think there's some, like 100 different experiments that they have planned between the four of them. Three of them have never gone up before, but they were, they were wealthy people that, that could pay probably $50 million each. I didn't see a number, but I'm just guessing. The commander of the mission is Michael Lopez, Algeria, and he's a ham, KE5GTK. Now he works for Axiom. He spent many, many years with NASA. He had the record for the most amount of EVAs. I think he flew 6 different times in space. But now, of course, he retired from NASA, but now he works for the Axiom, and he'll be our commander of the Axiom 1 mission, is what they're calling it. They're planning another Axiom 2 mission, many months from now. And then by the time they get to the third one, they think that by that time they'll have their first module actually attached to the forward end of the space station, the Harmony module. But we'll see how that goes. Larry Connor, Mark Patsy, and Ethan Stibble. He's from Israel. Ethan was she's had a past with Raymond, another guy from Israel. He was on the STS 107 mission, which happened to be the Columbia mission, and eventually burnt up in the atmosphere when one of us returning. When it was returning from the space station. Correction, they never went to the space station, but when it was returning through the atmosphere. Unfortunately, we lost seven people. He was one of them. Now, this guy was, fellow that died on Columbia. When he was in Israel, he was a fighter pilot, one of the best fighter pilots that they had. And one of the younger guys at the time was this guy, Ethan Sybil. So he knew him, he trained with him. So it's pretty interesting that this guy's got, he's got a chance to, go to space and hopefully make it back this time. Any questions or comments before I move on? WS2M. Static, but okay. On April 15th, another Falcon 9 is going to be launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, and that's a government satellite mission that will be going up, sending a satellite into polar orbit. The NRO sends satellites up on a regular basis. Sometimes they're geosynchronous, sometimes they're polar. In this case, it's going to be polar, so they have a contract with SpaceX to do that. That's going to be followed again in April by on April 20th. It's a crew mission also to the International Space Station. So you can tell by the dates. On the 6th, the other crew is going up. On the 16th, they're supposed to be returning, 16th to 17th, to Earth. And that brings the personnel on the International Space Station from 10 back down to 7, back down to, oh wait, from 11 back down to 7. And now we're going to go back up to 11 again once with this crew mission of 4 people going to the space station.
This is November Echo 2 X-ray.
November 2, just one letter. November 2 question mark X-ray. Yeah, okay. And good news with this flight. There's a couple of hands going up on this one. November 2 question mark X-ray. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to tell you that the call here is November Echo 2 X-ray. And just listening to your conversation, and you guys, it's very interesting. So that's it. Name is Al on Eric London, and we're in Clifton, New Jersey, and I'm just listening to your conversation. Thank you.
Great, Al. Very good. Welcome aboard. And we're here every Sunday night. Like Roy says, and that has been going on like for 40 years. So we are here every Sunday night. Starts at 8 o'clock and usually finishes up around 11 o'clock. And our boy is net control, AC2GS. I'm sure you've heard that before. Anyway, this crew that will be going up to the space station, Jell Leningrad, is also a ham, KO5MOS. And he's been up to the space station before. He's got three crew members. Now, this is a NASA flight, by the way. This has nothing to do with commercial. These people will be going up for 6 months. And he's got two new astronauts that never went up before, Robert Hines and Jessica Watkins. And then you have another astronaut from the European Space Agency, Samantha Christopher Eddy. She's got a call of IZ0UDF. It's nice that they have the calls, but when they operate from the space station with ham radio and talking to either private individuals on Earth or mostly school contacts through ARIES, the amateur radio on the International Space Station program, they use the space station pool, you know, N1 zero, N1 ISS, sorry. That's what the Russians have their own pool, and the European Space Agency sometimes uses the Belgian pool. Most of the time, it's just the American pool or the Russian pool. But some of these guys, I'm willing to say, over the years, it looks like about 50% of astronauts that go into space now have their ham radio tickets, which I think is great. So they'll be up there for 6 months, and then, of course, another crew will eventually replace them. But during that 6 month stay, they'll see cargo ships come and go. They'll see Cygnus cargo vehicles being launched by Antares here in the United States from Virginia, docking with the space station for food and clothes and equipment for the spacewalks and science experiments. And you'll have Progress vehicles still being launched by the Russians. They'll be docking with the space station as well. You have the Crew Dragon vehicle, which is on the Crew Dragon vehicle, and you have the Cargo Dragon vehicles, which go up to the space station, and the cargo ones will be docking with the space station as well. And then there's another one that tried to make it back in 2019 in December by Boeing, called the Starliner. And unfortunately, that one never made it in that month of December of 2019. It got up into orbit. They had problems. The computers weren't talking to each other properly, and this unmanned Starliner vehicle, which will eventually be manned if they ever succeed in docking with the space station, wound up running out of fuel. So NASA deorbited it, and that vehicle eventually landed safely in New Mexico, where it's supposed to, on land. Once they get that working properly, that would be a good setup for NASA, because you'll be able to actually have a vehicle land on land instead of dragging lands in the water. But hopefully that crew that goes up there will see that thing dock with the space station. And if it does, they'll open the doors, they'll have some cargo on board. But, you know, the idea is to test that vehicle, the Starliner, to see if it's capable of docking with the space station, undocking with the space station, deorbiting and landing back in New Mexico. But this crew will get a chance to actually go inside. I mean, it's very similar to what the Dragon did a few years ago with their uncrewed vehicle. And then after that, NASA approved it. Since then, we're up to now crew number 4 going up to the space station. So Starliner will be a redundancy system. You know, once they have things going on a regular basis, you'll have Crew Dragon bringing crews up and then back down, and then you'll have Starliner doing the same thing. And if one ever fails for any reason, you know any kind of problems with it, where they can't launch, they'll have the other one. So that's what NASA always needs, is redundancy. Any questions? WS2F. Okay, nothing hard for now. I'm talking about solar, the light actually, from the sun pushing a spaceship along. And they know that it works. They've tried it before. The Planetary Society has actually launched a light, they call it a light sail. Now there's another company in France that they plan on building bigger ones. They have a small one going up in October. And now this company has only been around for a couple of months. They call it Gamma. That's the name of the company. G-A-M-A. And Gamma is planning on launching a small couple of CubeSats put together. And then once it's in orbit, it's going to start spinning. And inside this CubeSat, it's going to start opening up a Mylar type of solar sail. It's going to open up to, like, I don't know, 700 some odd square feet. Very thin material to be able to do that. But once it does, they expect to see it, you know, be able to hold its own in orbit. Instead of, it'll be a relatively low orbit, I think only a couple hundred miles up, where the air is kind of, or the space is kind of very rarefied, but, you know, it has some molecules up there, especially to start to slow things down. So, you know, if you just had a satellite up there inside of maybe, you know, a year or so, it would start to deorbit. Now, with the solar panel expanded, they expect to keep that in orbit for quite a few years as a test. And if that's successful, they plan on building a much bigger one to launch in 2024. And their plan is to have this thing fly to Venus, really under solar power. And eventually when it gets to Venus, maybe even slow it down with solar power to put it actually into orbit. They're thinking about that as well. But that would have to be a very, very large solar panel to do that. But that works with actual light. You know, it's not using physical protons or electrons to push it along. It's using photons, and that's where that conversation about radiometry. If you look at roy.ac2gs.com, you can go to that website. First thing up, you got a picture of this thing. And the question, you know, comes in: is that thing really spinning because of, you know, the light is actually hitting it, or is it, you know, some other mechanism that makes that spin? Not, you know, that was always in question years ago with Dick K. To RIW, so I could talk about that. But as far as the solar sail is concerned, that is, you know, that has been confirmed in the past, and it's just going to get better at it. The idea of this company is, instead of having mechanisms pull this, you know, thing open into this, you know, squares type of solar panel, they're going to use the centrifugal force. So once this satellite starts spinning in space, and they, you know, they release the brackets from the centrifugal force, it will expand. By doing that, they cut back on the brackets, and you could actually have a lighter, larger sail for whatever size type of satellite you use. So I think that's pretty good. Any questions? WS2N. Okay. And I'm sure that'll be one of the topics next week that Roy will discuss the mechanism behind the radiometer. And one good thing about his website, it doesn't go away, so next week it'll still be there. It'll be there for months on end. I was going to talk about the Mars sample return mission that's planned for actually a couple of years from now. NASA has big plans to bring back samples that have been collected by the Perseverance Mars rover, now riding around on that planet for a little over a year from now. Last year, in February 18th, they landed Perseverance. Here we are, a year and a couple of months since the landing, and I think it's doing great. I mean, it put the helicopter up there. The helicopter Ingenuity is doing terrific. It's flown over 20 flights now. They thought it was maybe it was land. They were going to be happy with 5 flights. They got over 20. But Perseverance, one of their main goals before they even thought about helicopters was to drill into different rocks, any hard surface on Mars, and put the, you know, put a core sample instead of just dust. The previous rovers that went up, Spirit, Opportunity, Curiosity, they drill, but they get dust, and the dust is, you know, that comes from the drilling into the body of the vehicle, and yeah, ways of analyzing it. All kinds of exotic ways of analyzing it. You can tell what it is. But they would like to get samples back. If you can get a sample back from Mars, on Earth they have equipment here that you can't send to Mars. I mean, it's the massive stuff that, you know, that they're going to use to analyze this stuff, you know, from this, you know, 7 ways to Sunday. But the trick is to get it home. So the plan was to, as of last week anyway, before they changed this, was to send two rockets from Earth. You already have Perseverance on riding around on Mars, but send 2 separate rockets from Earth. One would go directly to Mars, enter the atmosphere, land right in Jezero Crater. That's where Perseverance is located now. And a smaller rover would riding out. Looks like the one that's designing has around 4 wheels instead of 6. But it will be able to move quicker through the landscape. And the idea is to pick up all these tubes. They're going to leave these. They're like bigger than test tubes, but you know, they're going to pick them up with a robotic arm and bring them back. The idea was to bring them back to the lander where the thing just landed, and the little robot would drive over and put it into this other piece that's attached to a solid booster or a solid two-stage rocket. You know. And that was being developed by Northrop Grumman, that two-stage solid fueled rocket. The idea was to launch this thing from Mars, go into orbit. And that's where the second launch comes from. You know, first launch was Perseverance. Second launch is this rover to go drive around and pick up all the test tubes, what I call test tubes, all the sample pieces. I think there's like 30 of them. Well, will be 30 by the time this thing lands. And then the third launch would bring the spacecraft into orbit around Mars, and that one doesn't land. So now this solid two-stage rocket with samples on board goes up into orbit around Mars, docks with this other spacecraft, and then in turn has an engine to get out of the orbit of Mars and go back to Earth. I want to get back to Earth. Eventually, the samples are transferred to a capsule, a descent module, might call it, heat shield and everything. It'll come through the atmosphere, parachutes, heat shield, parachutes, and then land in Utah. That's the plan. But now they've added another flight to this. So you're going to have the Perseverance launch. You're going to have the probe launch and the orbital launch. But now, instead of having, you know, the solid booster rocket and the rover landing at one time, they're going to have 2 separate lands. So that's where you need the other rocket. So now you're going to have the rover land separately, and then you're going to have this rocket built by Northrop Grumman on a different, completely different rocket, different landing system. NASA feels by putting the two together, it would need a very large heat shield to carry that kind of weight down to the surface. It would also need a larger fairing for launching the rocket. And the fairings would close everything during launch, so it would require that as well. So, it's also untried technology. They haven't done that yet. But they have landed things separately, so that's what they're going to do. They can bring the rover down, similar to the other two rovers, Curiosity and Perseverance, come down with the sky crane and all. They know how to do that. They have equipment on board, computers on board that look at the surface. It flies itself. It maps itself out as it's going down. It knows not to hit a cliff. It knows not to hit go into a crater. It knows not to hit a boulder when it lands. But they know, they've succeeded with that. So they'll do that, and they'll do it again with this rocket. They'll both land in Jezero Crater. So I thought that was an interesting deal. I'm sure pour more money into the extra launch, but maybe they're going to save on the all the different innovations they'd have to do to try to do two landings in one. Any questions, comments, WS2N. Okay. There was another launch with a crew on board. That was on Thursday, March 31st, a couple of days ago. And this one was by Blue Origin. Blue Origin is the company that's owned by Jeff Bezos, same Jeff Bezos of Amazon. He's got this rocket company, Blue Origin, that has built a few of these New Shepard launch vehicles. And he's now getting to the point where he can launch the New Shepard on a regular basis. It's suborbital. It's above the common line. Common line is, 100 kilometers up, a little over 62 miles high. And then it comes back down. And the capsule separates from the booster. It comes down on a couple of parachutes and lands, not too far away from where it's a floor from. Turning the booster is reusable. The New Shepard booster comes flying that down through the atmosphere, rocket end first, and when it gets close to the landing, this liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket ignites, comes back and lands vertically. A couple of blades open up. So pretty interesting. So now he's up to the fourth flight of doing this. First flight was just the four people I was Jeff Bezos. He went up on that mission. Then the next flight after that, launched another four guys. That was one with a guy from Star Trek, Captain Kirk. He went up, and then after that, he had a couple more people. He launched it to six people. Now he's done it again with six people. It's the first launch of this year. They expect to do many more launches this year. By the time he gets to the end, if he does as many as he wants to do six or seven launches, he should be able to have enough seats for 42 people. I mean, it's not even a year yet, and he's already up to 18 people doing what he's doing. Alright, it's not orbital. They get a few minutes of zero G. They're not paying $50 million a shot to go on. I don't know what they're paying, but then it's not $50 million like the crew for Axiom going up to the space station. So, I don't know, is it worth it? I guess if you have enough money and you always were interested in doing that, If it was me, I'd want to go on the orbital flight, though. And I would pass on the end of Shepard. Providing out enough money. It needed an infinite amount of money. But eventually, those orbital flights should start to decrease in price anyway. We'll see. Commercial industry is coming along quite a bit. Between that and eventually Virgin Galactic, they're redoing something with their spaceship. So far, they've only done that one commercial launch. They had Richard Branson, the owner of that, go up on that one. But eventually, they might start doing this on a regular basis too. We'll have to see. They plan on also launching out of different locations too. They have planned launch this year in Scotland. They want to take off in Scotland, do a suborbital mission from that location. So that's it. Any questions? WS12. Alright, of course I always cover NASA. I always read about NASA. The most with them listening to everything that they've done for decades. And hopefully this next project, the SLS Space Launch System, gets off the ground. And this will be an unmanned mission around the moon and back. And now it's already out of the launch pad. Last week they had a rollout from the VAB building, the Vehicle Assembly Building, same building that used to house the Apollo missions. And they are now using that building to construct all the different parts of the space launch system, which consists of the core, two solid boosters, one for the port side, one for the starboard side, and of course the Orion spacecraft, which goes on top. And on top of that, they have the launch board system. So that's all put together in the Vehicle Assembly Building. They rolled it out. They had a band there and everything, NASA. It's the first time that this thing is making it to Launch Complex 39B. It's on a gigantic crawler, the same crawler that they used that for all the shuttle missions. They used it before that, they used it for the Apollo missions. And they even used it for a rocket that they were going to use for the Constellation missions, but they were canceled. So the crawler took 11 hours to drive to the location to the Launch Complex 39B. And when it goes out there, it's got the whole launch tower with it, the launch tower and the rocket. With the solid boosters attached, everything ready to go. And the idea of this whole test is to see how it goes. They're going to bring it out to the launch complex. And they're going to make believe they're going to launch. They want to bring it down to eventually 10 seconds before launch. Which means, eventually, during a process, it'll need the hours that's going to be there.
Time, complete.
Filling it up with fuel. You have the two solid boosters. Of course, they don't have to be fuel. They already are fuel. But you have the liquid hydrogen tanks and liquid oxygen tanks in both the core stage, the first stage, and the second stage that's sitting on top of the core stage. They all have to be fueled. So you have 196,000 gallons of liquid oxygen going into the main stage, followed by 530 some odd thousand gallons course, of liquid hydrogen. And then the upper stage, they had planned on filling it up with 5,000 gallons of liquid oxygen and 17,000 gallons worth of liquid hydrogen. And it's roughly a 2-to-1 ratio.